From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Day one of the Senate trial in the impeachment of President Trump. It was more than 12 hours of debate over the rules. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell controlling the trial with precision.
As I've been saying for weeks, nobody will dictate Senate procedure to United States senators.
Well, procedure is process, and the process is democracy, which is why, for Democrats yesterday, including Senator Chuck Schumer, they say that how this trial unfolds is a test of American democracy.
Because if the president commits high crimes and misdemeanors, and Congress refuses to act, refuses even to conduct a fair trial of his conduct, then presidents, this president and future presidents, can commit impeachable crimes with impunity, and the order and rigor of our democracy will dramatically decline.
Well, there are 100 senators serving as jurors in this trial. A spotlight, though, on several Republican senators who think for different reasons, multiple people think for different reasons, could determine the fate of the president of the United States. So this hour on Point, the view from key states on day one of the impeachment trial. And you can join us, listeners in Maine, Alaska, Utah, Kentucky. What are your thoughts on your senators and their roles in this impeachment process? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're going to start off today with David Graham. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, speaking to us today from Durham, North Carolina. He's also an instructor at Duke University's Center for Media and Democracy. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So your thoughts, your big picture thoughts on how this first almost, you know, more than 12 hours went in the trial of President Trump.
Well, I think it probably went about as well as both sides could have hoped for themselves. You know, for Mitch McConnell, he kept the caucus in line with one exception of Susan Collins breaking on a single motion. But pretty much party lines, Republicans didn't break. Everyone kept together. For Democrats, they didn't expect they were going to win any of these things, but they used a lot of time. I mean, I think they put some pain in a few ways. One, they forced the Senate to sit through and to make Mitch McConnell sit through the debate, which I'm sure he was not pleased about. They gave them an opportunity to force Republicans to take these tough votes that they're hoping will be useful in the election. And it gave them a chance to start laying out their case. So although they were ostensibly procedural, you heard them sort of previewing what they're going to say in their actual arguments in the coming couple days.
Now, many observers were noting how as the hours wore on deep into the night, things got pretty acrimonious to the point where, you know, as people probably heard this morning, Chief Justice John Roberts, who's presiding over the trial, he felt compelled to really interject and remind the senators of the decorum of the body in which they serve. This happened at about 1 o'clock this morning. So let's take a listen to what the Chief Justice said.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the President's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse.
That's Chief Justice John Roberts at 1 o'clock this morning. David, you're forgiven if you were actually asleep when this happened. but what was the chief referring to there?
Well, there is this somewhat tense exchange between Jerry Nadler, one of the House impeachment managers and the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and Pat Civiloni, who's the White House counsel. And, you know, I think people have been making similar arguments all day. Really, you're hearing the same thing. And Nadler went after the president's lawyers and said they were lying and said the president was lying and you know, said that the senators were conducting a cover-up. Cipollone then got up and said, you know, he owes an apology to the president and the president's family and to the lawyers and most of all and to the Senate, to the American people. So they were kind of going back and forth, and they were the sort of things you'd heard, but you could tell that tensions were rising. And I think if you watch a clip of Roberts' admonishment there, he looks tired. I mean, his body language, his facial expression, you can tell people were just sort of, they were ready to be done, but they still had a little while to go.
But we should note the number of hours that the senators and the Chief Justice are spending in the Senate chamber was determined by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. This is how he wants the trial to unfold in these big 12-hour blocks.
Well, you know, McConnell was hoping to wrap up at least these motions earlier, and at some, you know, as they ran into the night, he tried to cut a deal with Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and he said, you know, these motions are essentially similar. We know how the vote is going to go. Can we just have a vote on all of it at once? So they had a recess. They went and conferred, and they couldn't strike a deal. It sounds like Schumer wasn't ready to give up the chance to try to embarrass Republicans and to try to lay out some of the case. And so they had to keep going until almost 2 o'clock.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of what Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, said yesterday during day one of the Senate trial of President Trump. He repeatedly said the trial would be fair, in his view, in comparison to the process that took place in the House during the investigative portion of this impeachment. Republican senators reportedly convinced McConnell to make some changes to the rules just before the senators took a vote on them. But both sides, Democrats and Republicans, now get to spread 24 hours or get 24 hours to make their case over 3 days rather than two. However, McConnell was insistent that he would not budge on witnesses or documents.
The House chose not to pursue the same witnesses they apparently would now like the Senate to pre-commit to pursuing ourselves. As I've been saying for weeks, nobody will dictate Senate procedure to United States senators.
Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader yesterday. Now, David, you just recently wrote that, in your view, the Senate can scarcely afford to hold a trial, but it also can't afford not to hold one. What did you mean by that?
Well, McConnell clearly isn't very excited about doing this. He wants to move through it quickly and acquit the president. He wants to do that before the State of the Union, and that's what the president wants. And also, he doesn't want to have this sort of spectacle. I don't think he sees it as good for members of his caucus and good for Republicans in general. But he can't really go through it too quickly. If he makes it too short and too much of a pretext, that could cut back on him too. You know, we see polls that show plurality support for impeachment. Some polls show even majority support for removing the president. And so if it's too fast and it's too hasty, there's a danger that will hurt Republicans in moderate states and in other places by making it clear that they're not really interested in considering something that polls show the American people think is fairly serious.
So he's walking a fine line. Do you think he's doing a good job at it based on sort of the rules that we ended up with at 2 o'clock this morning?
It's a little bit hard to tell what the long-term effects will be. I hesitate to look into the future too far, but I thought, you know, the rules are about the best he could hope for. They are a set of rules that it's what he wanted. He kept the caucus together, so he showed that Republicans are united, despite what what the political pressures might be. They're together. So I think this is what he was looking for, and I think he thinks it's right. And he tends to have a pretty acute political instinct.
Well, no doubt, right? I mean, as you heard him say, that no one's going to tell him how to run the Senate of the United States, and he's been kind of ruling with an effective iron fist there. Now, let's talk a little bit about Representative or Congressman Adam Schiff, who led the impeachment investigation in the House and is one of the House managers in the Senate trial here. He said this about the fight over process with Senator McConnell in his opening statement in the Senate yesterday. So here's Representative Adam Schiff.
I believe the most important decision in this case is the one you will make today. The most important question is the question you must answer today. Will the president and the American people get a fair trial? Will there be a fair trial? I submit that this is an even more important question than how you vote on guilt or innocence, because whether we have a fair trial will determine whether you have a basis to render a fair and impartial verdict. It is foundational, the structure upon which every other decision you will make must rest.
Congressman Adam Schiff. Now, David Graham, obviously, Schiff there making a very impassioned appeal to fairness in this trial. But the concept of fairness has also been appealed to by Republicans as well. So help us sort that out.
Yeah. So you saw Republicans responding to this, and the White House's lawyers saying, well, look, we should have had more opportunity to weigh in the House side of this. We didn't get as much chance as we wanted. And if you wanted fairness, they should have had fairness over there on the other side. I think you can see some fairly compelling arguments in both cases. Democrats say they didn't get certain evidence. They didn't call certain witnesses because the White House was stonewalling and obstructing. And there's something to that. The White House was stonewalling and refused to do these things. If it pushed too far, it would be getting onto the into the election. Republicans say, "Look, yeah, go ahead."
No, please, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
You know, Republicans say, well, you know, you should have done this if you wanted. You worked too hastily. And I think there's something to that as well. There was this interesting debate with Schiff saying, you've got to call witnesses and gather evidence before. You want us to make our argument and then call witnesses. Who's ever seen a trial in any courtroom that works that way?
Now, you've also written, I think you just wrote it yesterday. I don't even know when you slept, David, but but that you were sort of noting that that the president's defense attorneys were homing in or focusing in particular on Adam Schiff. Now, why?
Well, Schiff has become such a controversial figure, kind of unknown before any of this started, and now a bit of almost maybe a household name. He did this sort of weird sketch or parody of Trump's phone call in a hearing on September 26th, and it's become a sort of meme for the president and his supporters. So even though it doesn't really have any legal relevance, and no relevance to the impeachment, you saw them bring it up over and over again, accusing him of having this fraudulent conversation. And I think that's a little bit of a window into the way that the president's lawyers are playing to TV. They're looking to get sound bites. They're doing things they know will air well on Fox News. You don't see them so much playing to the audience in the Senate because they know that they have the votes.
Right. So that gets us to the question about how this is playing in the homes of the very voters that they may be trying to speak to. So when we come back, we're going to talk with folks from Kentucky, Maine, and Alaska as well. And we want to hear from you. Did you watch day and night one of the impeachment trial in the United States Senate? What are your questions for how all of this is unfolding? What do you make of it? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what transpired in day one of the Senate trial in the impeachment of President Donald Trump. David Graham joins us. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's with us from Durham, North Carolina today. And we're going to spend a lot of the rest of the hour checking in on several states with some key moderate senators. And we're going to turn to Maine here first. And let's listen to a little bit of what Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins told NBC News Center Maine on Friday. So this is before the trial started. She talked about how she's put together a roll call vote so that every senator's position is public.
I've worked very hard to make sure that in this governing resolution, there is language that provides for a roll call vote so each and every senator will be on the record on the question of whether or not additional information, witnesses, documents are needed.
That's Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine. Well, let's go to Augusta, Maine now, where Steve Mistler joins us. He's politics and government reporter for Maine Public Radio. Steve, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, my pleasure, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So how has Senator Collins' role thus far in the impeachment proceedings and now the trial, how has that been playing out amongst her voters?
Well, they're obviously keeping a very close eye on her, and what we've heard from voters recently and up until yesterday is that they expect her to be, to force witnesses or call witnesses to allow evidence, and that's even from people who are diehard Trump supporters. They expect her to play some kind of a role in ensuring a fair trial, and of course, Democrats and some independents, I think, are demanding that. Although they don't necessarily think that that's going to happen, I think they've felt burned by Senator Collins in the past, notably during her vote for Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee at the time, and then, of course, the GOP tax law, which preceded the Kavanaugh vote. And so they have become sort of, they're sort of jaded about Senator Collins and what she does in terms of going along with President Trump and what he wants, or Mitch McConnell and his desires. So I think that that's really the picture here. I mean, and in a lot of ways, it's a microcosm of the rest of the country. I mean, I think the polling shows that most people want a fair trial. They want evidence. They want witnesses. And so that's exactly the way it's playing here in the state of Maine.
It's so interesting, though, because then, except on every vote but one, as David was telling us, the votes were along party lines. So no new witnesses, no new documents, given what you said, that can't go over well with a lot of her voters.
No, I'm seeing a lot of the Lucy and Charlie Brown memes in my Twitter timeline. They're seeing a lot of that and a lot of just outright anger, frankly. And then on the right, I think there's an expectation that she's going to support the president. You know, let's not forget that in 2016, Senator Collins penned an op-ed in The Washington Post, I mean, essentially declaring President Trump unfit for office. Mm. And that op-ed has followed her throughout, and it generated a lot of suspicion and ill will from Republicans. And I think that remains in a lot of ways. So there, I did an interview with Republican voters back in the fall, and they're keeping a very close eye on her, and they expect that she will support the president and acquit the president. And if she doesn't, I mean, she is up for re-election this year, and she could draw a primary challenger, although I think it would be very difficult to find one at this point by the filing deadline. But it is a danger that she faces.
Yeah. Well, actually, Steve, let me just jump in here on that, because sure. We've got a caller from Maine who wants to make a point on exactly this. So Anne from Bar Harbor, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to shed some light on Susan Collins' behavior and the tea leaf reading regarding Maine's unique electoral landscape. Susan Collins depends on a legacy coalition of Republicans, independents, and moderate Democrats. And now with ranked choice voting, which is instant runoff, she's going to have to get over 50%, or she's going to be up against her second, third, fourth rankings. So that makes it more confusing. It gives people much more choices in expressing themselves on either end of the spectrum. Now, given that in 2016, Maine had CD1 was blue. Mm-hmm. We had an independent senator. We had a red governor, red CD2. And we flipped that in 2018. We have a very progressive Democratic governor right now, and we have a moderate Democrat in CD2 House seat. So that is sort of reading the tea leaves. Susan Collins is going to have to cast her net either to the right or to the left. And it's interesting to me to see how Mitch McConnell will let her cut loose from the herd to make some, quote, quote-unquote, independent votes to perhaps ameliorate some of her more independent and moderate voters.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for that call. And just on a side note, completely reading the tea leaves, one of my favorite big vocab words, tassiography. So tassiography from up in Bar Harbor, Maine. But Steve, to the point that Anne's making about ranked choice voting and in Collins' reelection bid, will it make a difference?
Well, it could. I mean, I think to project this far out, you might be getting a bit over your skis a little bit. But
or a lot. Think, yeah.
or a lot. But it is true that we do have ranked choice voting. It will be in place for the U.S. Senate race. And we do have a green independent candidate who's trying to qualify for the ballot. We also have an independent candidate who's qualifying for the ballot. And we have several Democrats that are vying for the Democratic nomination. So there is the possibility that ranked choice voting could determine the outcome if Susan Collins doesn't break that 50% plus one threshold, which is an outright majority. She would be automatically declared the winner if she was able to do that. If we don't get that, then we do get into a runoff scenario. But I think it's a little early to talk about whether or not that could happen, because we don't even know the field yet, quite honestly.
Yeah. Well, Steve Missler, politics and government reporter for Maine Public Radio, speaking to us from Augusta, Maine. Steve, thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me.
David, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but let's just get another caller here from Maine while we can. Nicomas is calling from Illsboro, Maine. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. How are you all doing?
Doing great. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I think I represent, you know, maybe a number of Democrats here in Maine that have at times voted for Susan Collins. And, you know, she's always sort of struck me as somebody that was a Republican but moderate, and I've enjoyed some of her talking points in the past. But at this point, you know, I'll be watching this very closely, and I think if after the Kavanaugh vote, and especially after this trial, if she doesn't give every indication that she has listened to the evidence and voted, you know, as the evidence would suggest one should, there's no chance that she'll have my vote. So I really wanted to sort of throw that out. And I think that there's a lot of people that feel that way.
Well, Nicomas, thank you so much for that call. David Graham, your quick thoughts on Susan Collins' role here.
Well, I think you hear everything. The Lucy and the football meme, I think, is a good description of the way a lot of people seem to feel about Collins. I think nationally, too, this is a sense. I thought Steve made a great point, too, about the danger of a primary challenger from the right. And I think that's something we see in a lot of these cases. And it complicates the challenge for McConnell as well. He has to keep his caucus in line. And if people stray too far and they're too unfriendly to the president, there's a real risk of a backlash against them. In their states, they could end up being challenged. They could lose primaries. That would also create a caucus that was harder for McConnell to wrangle in the future. So that's the course he's trying to steer. He wants to give people a little bit of flexibility, but not too much flexibility.
Well, let's swing all the way over to the other side of these great United States, over to Alaska, because we do also need to talk about the role that Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski is going to play in the coming days here. Now, she told the Anchorage news station KTVA 11 on Saturday that she was considering voting for additional witnesses to be brought before the Senate's impeachment trial.
If I determine that I do not have enough for me to fairly and honestly make that determination, if there is more that I need, I will vote to accept additional information by way of additional witness, by way of additional documents, by way of additional deposition. I don't want this proceeding to be a circus. I don't want it to be viewed as a mockery or a kangaroo court.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski on Saturday. Well, joining us now from Washington is Liz Ruskin. She's Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent. Liz, it's good to have you.
Hi, Magna. Thank you.
So is that how Senator Murkowski ended up voting on the dozen or so amendments offered yesterday?
No. And to be clear, in that press conference on Saturday that you just played a portion of, she was saying that she might vote later for witnesses, but she made it very clear. And she warned, she seemed to be sort of bracing herself for the onslaught that has indeed come. But she was saying that she will vote against the Democratic amendments to the organizing resolution. And that's, in fact, what she did.
I see. So give us a quick view, if you can, of how you think Alaskans are seeing their senator's role in this impeachment trial?
Well, her base, you know, Alaska is a red state and these are polarizing times, but her base is her supporters are a wide swath of Alaskans in the middle of the spectrum who admire her lack of partisanship. But she is forever disappointing liberals and conservatives in turns. And so, yeah, today I'm seeing a lot on social media from liberals who are just deeply, deeply disappointed. They didn't sort of hear her warning on Saturday, or at least they didn't think it was important. And they are just deeply disappointed that she voted to uphold the Republican drafted organizing resolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, give us the bottom line, Liz, here. Given how you know the senator and have followed her career, is there any chance at all that she would do anything other than vote to acquit the president?
Yes, I would say there's a chance, but she is a pragmatist. She's a moderate by nature. Mm-hmm. She's a pragmatist, and I think she has grave concerns about removing a president from office because it might make it easier to impeach future presidents. That's what she has said. So I think that it would be an uphill climb for her to vote for acquittal.
I see. Now, the senators are not allowed to talk or do anything pretty much during the many hours that they'll be sitting in the Senate chamber. So I was about to ask you, what will you be looking for in terms of Senator Murkowski's behavior or comments sort of outside the Senate chamber as the days go by to help us understand sort of how she might be thinking?
Well, I wanted to point out that it's interesting. She and Susan Collins, you know, they're all in their regular assigned seats, and she and Susan Collins are seated right next to each other. So I popped into the press gallery a little bit yesterday and saw, you know, that they were both sitting in sort of parallel language, taking a lot of notes, hands folded in front of them. So I was, you know, trying to read some body language there. There wasn't a lot to read. I don't know. Senator Murkowski put out a video last week, very concerned about people misinterpreting her and saying, you know, don't listen to robocalls, as if she might expect that people would put out robocalls misstating her position. So she says she'll be talking to Alaskans directly by self-produced videos.
Mm. Well, Liz Ruskin, Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent, thank you so much for being with us, Liz.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay, David, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but while we can, let's go back over to Kentucky, of course, home state of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Ryland Barton joins us now. He's State Capitol Bureau Chief of Kentucky Public Media. Ryland, it's good to have you.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so what are Kentuckians thinking, or at least those you've talked to, about how their senator is presiding over this trial?
Well, I think in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell's popularity goes with the popularity of the president, and he remains very popular in Kentucky. I think that Mitch McConnell has really been seen as he has tied himself, and I think that voters have tied him in their minds to the president. He, going back to the campaign, by not filling a vacant Supreme Court justice seat and paving the way for President Trump to make the Supreme Court pick a campaign issue, and that was something that was orchestrated by Mitch McConnell, and I think that looms large with voters here. And I think that when it comes to impeachment, I think that Republican voters, the base, they are on board with him and his support of the president and in all these proceedings. That to be said, you know, on the other side, there is a incredibly amped up and interested group of people who do not like the president and do not like Senator McConnell, who only continue to get more and more active as this process goes on. There are, regular protests that are held outside of Senator McConnell's offices in Louisville. And, you know, this is something that people are interested in. And in his reelection campaign this year, he has a ton of challengers. There are 9 Democrats and 7 Republicans who have filed. Granted, that part of that's because he's the Senate Majority Leader now, and his face is on TV a whole lot mm-hmm. more, and a lot of people are interested in this Senate seat.
Well, let's see if we can sneak a call in here before the break. Debbie is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm a Democrat from Kentucky. And Mitch McConnell is probably our main focus for the 2020 election. Most of us don't agree that he said he's going to give a fair trial, but he's not. It's in no way. When have you ever been to court in a trial and not had witnesses? And I think he's probably more dangerous than even Trump. I think that if America wants rid of Mitch McConnell, then we need the whole country behind us. in doing this.
Well, Debbie, I'm going to take it back from you there. I'm so sorry, but it's just because I have to take a quick break here. But Debbie from Lexington, Kentucky, thank you. Ryland, we've got about 30 seconds here. Debbie obviously feels passionate about this, but how big is the opposition to McConnell in Kentucky? I mean, Kentucky is quite a red state.
It's quite a red state. I'd say that, you know, his opposition is, you know, really rooted in Kentucky cities and Lexington and Louisville, but it's a very rural state. A lot of the population is pretty spread out. It all kind of comes down to how activated these voters are going to feel. And, you know, the Democrats are feeling pretty high in Kentucky right now. They just ousted an incumbent Republican governor.
Well, Ryland Barton, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Media. Ryland, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Magna.
And David Graham, stand by, because when we come back, we will check in with what's happening in Utah. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what transpired yesterday and early this morning in day one of the Senate trial of President Donald Trump. We've been hearing from reporters in some key states across the country, and also joining us is David Graham. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's with us from Durham, North Carolina today. He's an adjunct instructor at Duke University Center for Media and Democracy. We want to know if you watched any all of yesterday's proceedings in the Senate. Do you think the trial that will unfold will be a fair trial? And David, I was wondering if you could just reflect with me a little bit more about the things that we were hearing our local state reporters say in that past segment. It sounds like in the cases of Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski, that Mitch McConnell is going to be, I mean, you said this before, but let's dig into it a little bit deeper, kind of trying to like find this balance of allowing them just enough independence, but keeping them in line as well. How does that work?
Well, I think one way it works is to try to get everybody together on these initial votes. So everybody's going to vote for the same rules. He wants to keep them together. We see people like Collins and like potentially Murkowski wanting to see witnesses. And I think that's a place where he can maybe give a little bit of space. So we'll hear these arguments from both sides, and there'll be a vote on hearing witnesses and hearing evidence. Democrats are going to be really hoping they can peel off enough members of the Republican caucus to get some witnesses heard. That may still be a pipe dream. But if McConnell has the votes to win, I think he can let a couple senators go. So he can let Susan Collins vote for that if she wants, or he can let Lisa Murkowski, they can do what they want, but he can more comfortably allow that. And it's by putting it later in the process, he still has the major things in line. But that way, the members have a little bit of flexibility, potentially.
I see. So we're about to turn to Utah here to talk about Senator Mitt Romney, Utah Republican. What do you see his role here as?
Boy, no one knows. Romney is a little bit of a mystery because he's been more critical of Trump publicly, I think, than almost probably any other Republican senator. But you also saw him yesterday saying that Democrats are sort of playing too much to outrage and playing his cards pretty close to the vest on what he might actually do and what he would actually vote for.
Well, to that point, let's play the interview that he had with CNN's Manu Raju yesterday. This is Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney.
I think the Democrats make a mistake when they cry outrage time and time again. If everything is an outrage, then nothing is an outrage. So the big issue, I think, relates to witnesses and the discussion of witnesses. The vote on witnesses that counts is going to be after opening arguments. My guess is today they're going to have lots of motions on witnesses. We've all told them we're not going to deal with that now. We're going to deal with that after opening arguments, just like during the Clinton process.
Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney speaking yesterday on CNN. Well, joining us now from Salt Lake City, Utah, is Sonia Hudson, politics reporter for KUER, Utah's NPR station. Sonia, it's good to have you.
Hi, Magna.
So how has Senator Romney's sort of role in this impeachment and the trial, how has that been playing amongst Utah voters?
Yeah, so Utahns are, like the rest of the country, really split on impeachment. There was a poll back in late November and early December that showed, 43% of Utahns thought that Congress should remove Trump, 47% said they shouldn't. And that split is actually, somewhat surprising in a really, really Republican state. And so I think you kind of see split reactions on how Mitt Romney has been handling the impeachment process.
Well, in that clip, he said that the vote that counts regarding witnesses in the trial is going to be the one after opening arguments. What do you think he means there?
So he issued a statement the night before impeachment proceedings began on Monday night. He issued the statement that said he would not vote on calling witnesses until after opening arguments. We've heard that from some other moderate Republican senators as well. And so he stuck with that. He voted against Democratic pushes yesterday to call witnesses and to subpoena documents. And he has said that he wants to hear from witnesses, specifically former National Security Advisor John Bolton. And so we'll see if he sticks with that and votes to call those witnesses.
David, do we know if such a vote's going to happen after opening arguments?
Well, I think there will be a vote, but we don't know exactly what it will look like. Who might be called or whether there'll be something. There's a talk of sort of horse trading where Democrats might say that they would be happy to allow Republicans to call Hunter Biden in exchange for calling John Bolton, for example. Some sort of tit for tat. But we don't know what the resolution will look like or how things will look after we've heard the arguments. And I think McConnell is hoping that his caucus will hear the opening arguments and say, we've got enough here to decide. We don't need to hear any more. Let's move on.
Right. Well, Sonia, let's turn back to the fact that, as we heard, Senator Romney has been one of the most vocally critical Republican senators critical of the president. Has that sort of rebounded on him in any way in Utah?
So Romney and the president have a really interesting relationship going back to 2016. Romney was one of the most vocal critics of President Trump while he was running and has continued to be. But they have worked together on some things. More recently, they had a discussion at the White House about the youth vaping crisis, which is one of Romney's biggest issues. And Trump does not have a very high approval rating here in this very Republican state. It's about 50, just above 50%. So that's somewhat surprising also. And so you see some people who really like that Senator Romney stands up to Trump, and you have some people that are really big supporters of the president who don't like that he's being critical.
Yeah.
So it's pretty split, I think, is the big takeaway here.
Well, let's hear from a Utahn herself. Catherine's calling from Vineyard, Utah. You're on the air, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a constituent of Senator Romney and Senator Lee, and I'm part of a grassroots organization called Mormon Women for Ethical Government. And we've been actively pushing for our senators to vote for a free and fair trial. And last week, we delivered over 1,000 letters to 43 senators, 43 states, and we are not backing down. But we're also a nonpartisan organization. My main purpose in calling was to correct the popular misconception that Romney and Lee are going to have to act against their interests if they support witnesses. And this isn't the case because, as our reporter said, there is some push here in the state for an open and fair trial. And we believe in fair play as a people here.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, then what did you make of Senator Romney in day one of the trial? I mean, he pretty much voted entirely along party lines in the dozen or so amendments that came up for a vote.
Yes, it was a little bit disappointing, but we do still have hope that he believes in fairness and is willing to stand up for the rule of law.
Yeah. Catherine, thank you so much for that call. Sonia, did you just want to respond to Catherine?
Yeah, I wanted to also point out, you know, Romney does have a certain amount of freedom to kind of do what he thinks is right. He's not up for re-election until 2024. And so, you know, talking about that push to do what's right, he has a little bit more freedom than, you know, some other senators to vote his conscience. And, you know, he will also be 75 by the time his re-election runs around. So comes around. And so he may not even want to run for re-election. So he has a little bit more flexibility than some other senators we've been talking about this hour.
Well, Sonia Hudson, politics reporter at KUER, Utah's NPR station, speaking to us from Salt Lake City. Sonia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Marco, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Marco, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Marco, and I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska. And basically, I'm not taking any position on the issue, but I would like to remind your listeners, as well as anybody else that is a voter in the United States, to contact their direct phone line in Congress, which is area code 202 for Washington, D.C., and then the number 224-3121. I'll repeat, 202-224-3121. They will have access, direct access to their senator or congressman, and there's actually a person that responds, and you can tell him, first of all, your position, and secondly, see how your senator is standing on this very, very important decision.
Yeah. Well, Marco, thank you for that. It's a good reminder how even in the age of digital media, how getting on the phone in Washington still might be a really effective way of getting in touch with your senator. But Marco from Omaha, thank you so much for that call. Okay, so David Graham, we've got a couple of minutes left with you here, and I just want to play two more bits of tape from day one of the Senate trial yesterday. So first of all, here is White House counsel Pat Cipollone yesterday saying that House Democrats' allegations of obstruction is, quote, ridiculous, and that the president deserves a vigorous defense.
They come here and they ask you to do what they refuse to do for themselves. They had a court date and they withdrew the subpoena. They evaded a decision and they're asking you to become complicit in that evasion of the courts. It's ridiculous. And we should call it out for what it is. Obstruction for going to court? It's an act of patriotism to defend the constitutional rights of the president. Because if they can do it to the president, they could do it to any of you, and they could do it to any American citizen. And that's wrong.
It's the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. Now, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke on the Senate floor at the beginning of yesterday's session. He called out his Republican counterpart, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, throughout the day for what Schumer says is an unfair process. Here's Senator Chuck Schumer.
The very least we can do is examine the facts, review the documents, hear the witnesses, try the case, not run from it. Not hide it, try it. Because if the president commits high crimes and misdemeanors, and Congress refuses to act, refuses even to conduct a fair trial of his conduct, then presidents, this president and future presidents, can commit impeachable crimes with impunity, and the order and rigor of our democracy will dramatically decline. The fail-safe, the final fail-safe of our democracy will be rendered moot.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer yesterday. David, my last question to you is, we can examine the proceedings with a fine-tooth comb, and we will. But a lot of people out there are wondering if indeed the final outcome is as maybe yesterday's all party line votes indicate it might be. What's really at stake here? Why does this trial matter?
Yeah, I mean, thinking through this conversation, I think we're a little bit open to charges of cynicism that we're not really talking about the case. We're talking about the electoral effects. But I think the process is a little cynical. And because we do have an expectation of the acquittal, I think when this matters is in November. I mean, it affects the way people think about the president and whether they think that he's gotten a raw deal or whether he committed high crimes and misdemeanors and got away with it. And it affects the way they think about their senators. This is for all of the talk about how, you know, Democrats want to overturn the 2016 election. I don't think this is about 2016. This is about 2020, ultimately.
Well, David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic and adjunct instructor at Duke Center for Media and Democracy, with us today from Durham, North Carolina. David, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Magna.
Okay, so to this idea that what really matters is 2020, I want to turn now to Anthony Brooks. He's the senior political reporter here at our home station of WBUR. You also hear him occasionally in this chair as On Point host as well. Anthony, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, Magna. Thanks
now,
for having me in.
Usually, under normal circumstances, speaking of 2020, this would be a week that you'd be like traveling to Iowa, New Hampshire to cover the presidential race. What's going on?
So it was sort of interesting. So my focus, because we're in Boston and New Hampshire is sort of in our backyard, we spend a lot of time looking at the New Hampshire primary because of the impeachment schedule. You know, I woke up Sunday and started to look ahead. What am I going to be doing this week in New Hampshire? And I look at the schedule, which I do on a regular basis, and nobody's in New Hampshire. Mainly because Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, of course, have to serve as jurors in the impeachment trial. Only Tulsi Gabbard had events in New Hampshire this week. She, as you probably know, she moved to New Hampshire in December.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's had a real effect. I mean, we are less than 3 weeks away from the New Hampshire primary, and the fact that nobody is there is really telling. Now, I want to update this a little bit because I've noticed that Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts, in his long shot bid to capture the primary, is now heading up to New Hampshire on Thursday. He's got some events up there later this week. And by the end of the week, Joe Biden will be in New Hampshire, so will Pete Buttigieg. So people are coming back. Still surprising that so little action, so such a short time before the New Hampshire primary.
So interesting. So Deval Patrick, maybe belatedly realizing there's an opening to draw.
He can have the whole state to himself, pretty much, or at least duke it out with Tulsi Gabbard up there, who, by the way, is suing former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for defamation over her comments on a podcast suggesting that Gabbard is a Russian asset. So lots of intrigue up there on that score.
So Anthony, you've got so much experience covering presidential elections here. And just sticking with New Hampshire for a second, I mean, that whole retail politics thing is a hallmark of the New Hampshire primary. How much of a difference is it going to make that, you know, the top, a bunch of the top contenders right now in the Democratic field are locked up inside the Senate for several days?
I think it's going to make a big difference. I mean, it creates a very different feel for the candidate because, as you said, for the campaign, because, as you said, instead of having that retail politics on the ground, A, they're not there. The thing that they have tried to do this week is send up surrogates. So, for example, Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is going up to New Hampshire to campaign for Warren. So is Ashley Judd, by the way. I'm not sure why, but she's a surrogate. Bernie Sanders has dispatched Ben and Jerry, founders of Ben and Jerry Ice Cream, a sort of Vermont and now global institution. They're going to be campaigning in New Hampshire for Bernie Sanders. So that's a very different feel, sort of sending up. I mean, they're always surrogates, but surrogates are always like, you know, kind of the in the way, way, way back of the bus. And what New Hampshire voters expect are the candidates.
Exactly. Okay, so you're going to be in Iowa
next week. Yeah, I'll be in New Hampshire sort of for the rest of this week and early next week, then heading out to Iowa Wednesday night so that I can be in position Thursday, Friday through the weekend before the caucuses on Monday.
Okay, so we're going to check in with you hopefully frequently over the next coming weeks. Anthony Brooks, senior political reporter here at WBUR. Thank you so much, Anthony.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.